This morning is the last Sunday of Epiphany, also known as Transfiguration Sunday. And so we'll be in that narrative this morning. But maybe to get us started, just turn to someone next to you and maybe think through a season of your life where you felt close to God. What was happening? What did you feel in those times? Maybe some of us, we've never had that season, and you can share your thoughts on that. But just think through that a little bit, and then if you're willing to, just turn to someone next to you and share a season where you felt close to God. All right? Go discuss. All right. I recognize that I just asked a pretty involved question, and I'm probably not giving you enough time. But maybe something for us to, like, just to think through this talk. And I was thinking through this, and one particular season comes to mind. I had just graduated college in Canada, in Toronto. I had a degree in political science, so I had lots of job offers. And I was just trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. I knew a lot of what I didn't want to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so somehow I thought, well, let me go to a place where I can think of, you know, things of God and the theology. And so I went off to seminary. I'm not sure why. People would ask me, do you want to be a pastor? I'm like, I don't know, right? So I moved to Chicago, went to grad school. I got there. I didn't like it. I was introduced to an American Christian subculture that from Canada I was just unfamiliar with. And I was just, what is this? You know, I don't know what's happening. And then there was just such a disconnect from these academic ideas and life. And God's presence never felt more absent than in that time. And all this was happening, I was just bleeding money, just, you know, paying for my master's. And so I was frustrated, and I got this call through a friend of a friend to go speak at a church in Detroit. I'd never spoken before, and so, of course, I said, sure. So I got there, and I spoke. And after the weekend, the leadership sat me down, and they said, you know, Gideon, we'd like to hire you to be our pastor, and we'll pay for the rest of your seminary. I didn't really hear the first part. I kind of heard, I'll pay for the rest of your seminary. I was like, I'm in. I'll take it. And so I took this job, not knowing if I wanted to be a pastor. Karen and I got engaged. We moved to Detroit. And in those first few weeks, I was pastoring this little congregation at this little church. We were right on the edge of the city in the suburbs in Detroit. I was driving every day from my apartment to this little church. And there was this overwhelming, this sense of, like, every experience, all the setbacks I've ever had, God working in my life, like, to this moment. And there was just this sense of, Gideon, this is what I put you on earth for. It was amazing and overwhelming. And so for the last 17 years, I've been learning how to lead communities and pastoring. In the last 17 years, I may have had maybe one more season like that. And the question I want to ask is, when we have experiences like that, that are extraordinary, how do they inform the seasons that are just ordinary? When we have seasons that when we encounter light, we're going to be talking about the transfiguration, how does it inform and shape the way we engage into darkness? For centuries, this is the hinge Sunday where there's epiphany, and then transfiguration is like the ultimate epiphany. And it's this hinge where we now enter into darkness and death, preparing for resurrection. And if you read the scriptures, it's often like that. You have Abraham. He lived approximately 175 years. He had approximately 7 encounters with God. So with each encounter, he had to go approximately 25 years, a quarter of a century. So most of his life was just ordinary and day-to-day. But how did those extraordinary moments inform that and shape that? In Mother Teresa's memoirs, and it's just a collection of her diaries, she had this transformative experience when she was in her 20s. It changed her life. She gave up her entire life because of that experience to serve the poorest of the poor, and then went decades of searching and praying and a lot of silence. But she would always look back to that encounter, and it shaped and informed her life. And so as we prepare for Lent, as we prepare for 40 days where we focus on death, we die to some things in our life voluntarily to prepare for resurrection, I thought this would be a good conversation for us to have. And so this morning in Matthew 17, Jesus invites three of his friends that have a unique encounter that no one else in human history gets to have. And maybe we can ask, how did it inform them preparing for resurrection? How did it shape their lives? So we'll be in Matthew 17. Go ahead and read verses 1 through 9. We'll have it on the screens. Read it to each other, and we'll walk through. All right, go. All right, let's pick this up in verse 1. So it says, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John. So they've had about 6 days leading up to this text. Peter has had kind of like an up and down week. It starts well. Jesus gives him a pop quiz, and he goes, who do people say that I am? People are like, Elijah, John the Baptist, Jeremiah. And then Peter goes, you are the Christ. You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And then Jesus goes, well done, right? You're the rock. You're like a rock. I'm going to build my church on you, your leadership. And then so he has that high, and then Jesus goes, okay, for this to unfold, I'm going to have to die. And so Peter's like, okay, I'm going to start acting like the rock. And he's like, nobody's going to die on my watch. And then Jesus is like, okay, so you were the rock, and now you're Satan. And then Peter's like, okay, there's a little bit getting mixed messages. Not sure what to do. And then it gets more confusing. And Jesus talks about how their life now, they're going to have to take up like a device of execution. So for them, it was a cross. For us, we see it as a religious symbol. But it would be like Jesus saying, so your life now, you're going to have to take like waterboarding. Your life is going to be like waterboarding. And just think through that and let that define you. And you're like, what? This doesn't make sense, right? So 6 days pass. They're a bit confused. And he takes with them Peter, James, and John and led them up to this mountain. So they're going up to this mountain. They're having a mountaintop experience. Verse 2. There he was transfigured before them, his face. So his face starts to change. And it starts to glow. Like, I don't know if you've stared at the sun before. I know you're not supposed to. But some of you, maybe you've done it accidentally, right? So Jesus' face starts like glowing. Then his clothes start changing, became as white as light. So it's just like brightness and blindness. And then, just then, before them appears like two more figures. Okay, so if it's not crazy enough, it's like whiteness, brightness, and then like two guys show up. It's Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. So commentators say this, that it's possible that the writers are trying to contrast the experience on the mountaintop with Moses, who had one, Elijah, who has one, and Peter, who's about to have one. And so in Exodus 20, you've got Moses, who goes up on this mountain, and similar things happen. There's thunder, there's lightning, there's brightness, right? And then the people's response is like, okay, this is super terrifying. I don't want God to speak to me. So Moses, you go and you like take notes and then come back. And then it says Moses then turns and enters into this dark cloud where the presence of God is to listen. Then you've got Elijah on another time where he also goes up on a mountain. He's suicidal because the king and queen, who happen to be super evil, are after him. They're trying to kill him. So he's like, God, what's the point of this? Just God, why don't you kill me now? So he's suicidal. And then God bakes him bread. Like, imagine the aroma of bread when you're depressed. And he cooks it. And then says, hey, just eat this. Just calm down. Take a bite. Here's a drink. And then he falls asleep and naps. And then he's in this cave. And it says now the winds start to blow. And there's this hurricane that comes rushing, and it's so powerful that it starts an avalanche, and rocks are falling, and Elijah's sitting in the cave, like, okay, this is dangerous and scary, right? And the rocks are just falling. And then the earthquake comes, and you feel ripples in the ground, and then the whole mountain goes on fire. And he's like, I don't know what's happening. God's not in this, but this is, certainly isn't helping, right? And then it says, comes this gentle whisper. And then Elijah senses this is God, and he puts a cloak over him, stands at the mouth of the cave, and he listens. So Moses enters into the cloud and listens. Elijah stands at the mouth of the cave and listens. Peter now experiences God's glory of white shining, and then instead of listening, he just starts like babbling. He's like, all right, so yes, we should build structures, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And you almost sense in this text, like God's going up to a toddler, like putting, okay, just shut up. And then this voice comes and says, this is my son. Listen. Listen to him. And maybe a question we can ask this morning is, what does God's voice sound like in our lives? At work, what does God's voice sound like? In our struggles, in our pain, what does God's voice sound like? When people hurt us, what does God's voice sound like? If we were to, you guys, do you use iTunes or Spotify, or you know how they have a list of like the tunes you play the most and they rank them? If we were to do that in our lives, which are the voices, what are the soundtracks that are playing in our ear the most? Are they voices of fear? Are they voices of shame? Voices of arrogance? Whose voice is it? And where does God's voice play on that list? And in this experience, this voice is, okay, just stop talking, stop doing. Listen, this is my son whom I love. Listen to him. Last Saturday, I had the opportunity to go hear my man crush, Ira Glass, speak. Were any of you guys there? Okay, it was good. So he retells the story. I don't know if you've heard the one where this middle schooler in New Zealand gets bit by a shark. Do you remember that? So the story goes like this. She's hanging out on the beach, and on this particular beach, you could walk out really far, and it doesn't get deeper. So you can be hundreds of feet out, and you're still kind of like waist high. So she's hanging out with her friend. She's 13 years old, and while that's happening, she like feels something hit her, and it felt like a truck hit her, and it was a shark. And so the shark latched onto her side and just started like shaking, pulls her underwater once. She comes up, pulls her underwater again. She realizes the shark is trying to drown her. So her instincts kick in, and she just starts screaming and punching the shark, and then somehow frees herself. But now she's bleeding profusely, and so she runs back to the shore. There's no hospital nearby, and so they drive her to this little tiny clinic. The doctor stitches her up and says, gives her a couple, you know, pain pills. And he tells her parents, she'll be fine. We stitch it up. She'll probably be dramatic about this. Just ignore it. That was his last advice. So they're vacationing. They're hanging out in the RV. In the middle of the night, she starts going into shock. She starts throwing up blood. Her fever is like going high. Like her whole body is just burning up. She feels like every time she closes her eyes, it feels amazing, and she's being lifted out of her body. She's dying. So what happened was the shark had bit into her bowels, which was leaking into her internals. Her lungs were filling with fluid. And so she goes to her mom, and she's like, Mom, I feel really bad. I feel like I'm dying. And her mom goes, mind over matter. Because her mom's saying, the doctor told me she's going to be dramatic. So she's clearly being dramatic. So she comes again and again, and then finally is able to get her parents to listen to her. And Ira Glass says, when he heard this story, he said, this is a universal experience of middle schoolers. They have important things to say to adults, and adults are like, yeah, I already know. Or the adults just like tell them what to do. And they just want them to listen. And I wonder how many times we don't listen because we think we already know, or we have assumptions of how things are supposed to work out, or we just try to fix and do. And what if, especially in the season of Lent, when we're entering into darkness, into death, to create more space for listening? You know, a couple images came to mind when I thought of listening. My niece Gabby, she's sweet and beautiful and soft-spoken. And a lot of times she'll be standing next to me and she'll be talking. But because she's soft-spoken, often I don't hear her. And I'll feel a tug on my shirt. And I'll have to stop and kind of bend down, like intentionally, and then to listen. And I wonder what that looks like for us. That the Holy Spirit's speaking, or there's a voice. And we might need to stop and in this season of Lent to lean in. You know, another image that came to mind was, you've probably been in a restaurant or a bar or a show, and you're trying to have a conversation. And our friends took us to this wonderful restaurant this past Wednesday. And we were trying to carry a conversation, but the ceilings were low. And so I remember during the night, I was listening to them nodding, but I was catching every third word. And then in those moments where there's all this background noise, it's like all this white noise, and you step outside and it suddenly disappears and you can hear. And what would that look like for us to maybe intentionally, what's the white noise in our life? What are those sounds that are preventing us to really hear and to listen? And so in this narrative, you've got Peter who starts talking, who starts programming, who's like, we should build a monument, we should do this. And he's like, just stop and listen. And then their response then in verse 6, so when the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. So they fall to the ground. I kind of picture those fainting goats when like something scares them, like their limbs lock up and they just like tip over. Or they're on the ground, like in the fetal position, sucking. They're terrified. They're on the ground. And then what does Jesus do here? But Jesus came. So they're on the ground. So he's got to kneel. And then he touches them. So I imagine Jesus just sitting there, just like watching them. And then touching them. Say, hey, it's okay. Get up. And then they open their eyes. And they saw no one but Jesus. And I think it's interesting. Scriptures talk so often about fear. Some people say in the scriptures, it says, do not fear 365 times, one for each day. There's no correlation to that. That's not true. But the point is, it's just said a lot. That's true. But this is what I find interesting. When God says this in the scriptures, oftentimes, before they encounter God, they're not afraid. Often what makes them afraid is the encounter, which I think is interesting. Because I'd be like, okay, I wouldn't be afraid if you just didn't scare me, right? So that's one. And then often, they're in a place of stability. And then God invites them into a place of instability. And then that creates fear. So from Abram, he's like, hey, I've got this idea. So leave everything. I know you've been building up your wealth and your stability. And you've got like, you know, cattle and your family. And you've got this house. Just leave it all. I'm not going to tell you where you're going. I'm not even going to tell you what's the point. But don't be afraid. I'll be with you. Or Moses, hey, so you're going to leave the palace, you're going to convince your brother that you're going to take the slave labor that's built his empire, and then as they chase you, don't be afraid, because there's going to be a cloud, there's going to be a pillar, I'll be with you. And in those moments, God leads us into places of fear. Oftentimes, he doesn't take away the external which is causing us fear. And the promise is just this. It's empathy. I will be with you. I'll be with you in this situation. I will walk with you. Don't be afraid. I found this animation recently of Brené Brown, one of her lectures, and it kind of pictures this empathy. Check it out.
to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, I'm down. I know what it's like down here. And you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No. You want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time. Because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
I have a friend who a couple weeks ago, his wife wasn't feeling well, and she was getting really intense stomach pains, and so she went to the ER. So she called my friend and said, hey, I think I'm going to go to the doctor, I'm not feeling well. And so he was like, okay, hey, let me come. And he asked his boss, but I said, yeah, go ahead, just go be with her. So they went to the hospital, they went into the ER, and they got the stomach checked out, and then they left the hospital with a baby. They didn't know they were pregnant. She had the baby full term. I have a picture up here. She's beautiful and gorgeous. They named her Grace. He's not religious, but they named her Grace. And then I went to visit them. They had just got home from the hospital. Harmon and Jen had a bunch of baby clothes that they wanted to donate. They had nothing. They had no crib, no car, they had nothing. And so I went and dropped off some stuff that Harmon and Jen gave. And he had just got from the hospital. And so when I got there, he came and hugged me. He's not a huggy kind of guy. And he said, I'm so glad to see you. At the hospital, he was already a little overwhelmed. He got home and just had a full-fledged panic attack. And so we just sat there, and I was just with him. I didn't even do that much. I took a lot of pictures of the baby. I was one of his few friends that had kids, and he just asked my experience. And I just thought I went to visit the baby with him. And I went to see him a couple days ago, and he looked great. And I was like, hey, how's it going? He's like, it's amazing. He's like, we didn't plan for it. We didn't think we were ready. He's like, I've never been this happy. And he said, but I want to say thank you for being there that day. And I just needed someone who kind of knew what I was going through to walk through it with me. And just the power of being with, the power of God saying, I am with you. My name will be God with you. And to think through the what Jesus does. And as he comes as God, he doesn't solve all of poverty. I mean, it's interesting. He doesn't heal every sick person. He doesn't solve all the problems, but he walks among us and with us. I think about the story of Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so the Babylonians had pillaged Jerusalem, and they took their finest, like the strongest and the best educated, and then they brought them into the empire to put them to work. And the king's name was Nebuchadnezzar, and he was a bit of a narcissist, like slightly. He built himself a 90-foot statue, which should be the height of the state capital. That's how tall it is. So imagine building a statue of yourself and saying everyone needs to bow to it. And if you don't bow to it, you will die. I will burn you. So he had some emotional issues that probably needed a bit of therapy. So he does this, and these three guys are like, no, I'm not going to do it. And so he's like, I will burn you. And he just like throws them into the furnace, and then he heats it up. He's like, look, turn it up 7 times. It's so hot that the men throwing them into the fire die. And in the story, God doesn't solve the situation. He doesn't turn down the heat. And as they're in the furnace, Nebuchadnezzar sees something strange, that they start moving around. And not only do they start moving around, they threw in three of them, but there's four of them walking around. And he says the fourth one looks like the Son of God. And I wonder how many times in our fear and the things that we're terrified of, and we just want God to fix it and solve it and take it away. And he says, no, I won't, but I'll be with you. And so it says, when the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. Get up, he said, don't be afraid. When they looked up, they saw no one but Jesus. And then in verse 9, it says this. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them. What does it say? Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. So historically, the church and our faith has been invitational, right? As the church starts, people are invited into it. But what's interesting is if you read what Jesus says, rarely does he say, hey, tell everyone. Almost always he goes, hey, don't tell anyone. So there was a time this leper came, and he's ostracized from the community. He's losing feelings in parts of his limbs. Some of them are falling off. And then he heals him. And then he goes, okay, now I know I just gave your life back. Now, don't tell anyone. There was another time where Jairus, his daughter's dead. Jesus raises his daughter from the dead, and he goes, don't tell anyone. There's another time they're in the temple. The religious leaders are trying to trap him. They're like, should we heal on the Sabbath? Look at this guy. He's got a petrified arm. And the guy, Jesus is like, okay, this guy's a human being. Why are you, what are you doing? Of course I would heal him. So he heals him, and he goes, and the only time he says to go home and tell everyone was that one time there's a guy who's living on the fringes, and he was possessed with a legion of demons. And Jesus goes, what's your name? And you imagine like multiple voices coming, like terror, legion, right? And then Jesus sends that legion into the pigs. The pigs run off a cliff, and then they drown themselves. And then Jesus goes to him and says, go home and tell everyone. So this is my proposal. My proposal is that when we have moments of epiphany, when you have moments that are extraordinary, inherently that experience is invitational. Like if you experience it, your instinct is to go tell someone. So Jesus has to tell them, okay, now's not the time yet, so don't say anything. I know you want to say something, don't say anything. And then now you fast forward to where we are, and somehow we have to manufacture and say, hey, we need to go. Like, what's that gap there? And to think through, what is that experience that is so exciting, so beautiful, so real, that you can't not tell someone? It reminds me of the Kristen Wiig character, I think Excited Sue, where when she has exciting news, she has to tell somebody. And so in this story, someone has told her that they're expecting a baby. They're going to surprise the parents, and she's not supposed to say anything to anyone. So check out the clip.
Please remember, do not say anything,
no.
Okay?
Yes.
Oh, God. Mom! Hi!
Hi!
Hi.
Dad.
How are you?
Nice to see you.
Doing well. Nice to see you.
Hey, what's everybody doing here?
Oh, they just stopped by. What's Aunt Sue doing?
Nothing. She's fine, right, guys?
Oh, They're gonna tell you something.
Sue!
It's nothing. What? Oh, there's just something gonna be out around here. No, huh? Is it a little person? Oh, no. Someone's gonna get fat. What? Oh, but not... 9 months from now. Oh, God, no. Cigars. Grandparents. Oh, God, here it comes. Oh, God, here it comes.
Sue, please, do not. Don't.
And you get the sense that in the scriptures, when there is that encounter, inherently it's invitational. And I just think it's worth us pondering. And as we're entering into the season where we as a community, we need to figure it out. How do we do this in an honest and genuine way? One thing we're going to try, and if you're in a midweek group, all the midweek groups are going to try doing this. So we're going to frame it around Luke 14, which is Jesus' invitation to the party. And we're just going to ask, who was invited? How did people respond to the invitation? What is this party that Jesus is inviting us into? And what does our invitation look like? And what we're going to try doing is there's this movement of flash fiction and microfiction called 55-word fiction. I don't know if you've heard of it. And so what we're going to try to do is have in all of our groups for us to maybe tell our story of Epiphany, to explain what the kingdom of God is, that party in 55 words. And then we're going to ask our friends outside of the church, just critique it for us. What do you think? Does this even make sense? Like, help us. Let us learn from to how to become an invitational community. And the point here is for all of us is to engage our own experience of Epiphany. And that experience that is inherently invitational, that is so beautiful, that the news is so good, we can't not tell. And so you've got Peter, James, and John, and you just imagine them coming down from the mountain, and they have no idea what the ensuing weeks have for them. And I pray that as we get ready and prepare for these next 40 days, starting on Wednesday, and we're going to have a liturgy, and then we're going to enter in together into this season of darkness to prepare us for the light, this season of the valley to prepare us for the mountaintop, and this season of death to prepare us for resurrection. And so let's pray together. And may we go and learn to speak of what we have encountered of God's magnitude. May we not cling to the holy moments when the heavens overshadow us. May we listen to Christ and follow him from the places of revelation to the places of mission. And may God shine light into our lives. May Christ be with us and prepare us when we encounter the extraordinary so that we may live in the ordinary. When we encounter him on the mountaintop, to persevere through the valley, and in times of light, while we're immersed in the darkness. And may we go in peace as we prepare for these 40 days. Darkness preparing for the light, death preparing for resurrection. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.